Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to another episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helbarg, and as you probably know by now, my co-host is Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition.
Welcome, everyone.
Today, our whole show is dedicated to blue news you can use as we talk with George Leonard about the Trump administration's impacts on our public seas and specifically what his new mega bill that Congress passed will do to the blue in our red, white, and blue. George is the former chief scientist at the Ocean Conservancy and now a science and policy consultant with an in-depth understanding of U.S. ocean policies. We've already had some Rising Tide episodes about the impact Trump 2.0 is having on NOAA, and about its plans to expand offshore oil drilling and deep sea mining while undermining the offshore wind industry. But there's been a little public talk about what this giant new bill will do to our ability to protect and restore our public seas. So George, before you tell us, maybe you can give us a little of your own background, how you connected with the ocean, got into marine science, and found your way to Ocean Conservancy.
Sure. Hey, David. Hey, Vicki. It's great to see you again and to be with you this morning. You know, my interest in the ocean goes way back to when I was 13 years old, and I was not in the ocean, but I was sitting on a couch watching Jacques Cousteau specials in the 1970s. And it was really then that I decided I had to spend my life really studying and working to protect the ocean. I am a marine scientist by training. I got a master's in marine science out here. I'm located in Santa Cruz around the beautiful Monterey Bay. And I came out here to study California kelp forests, which are still near and dear to my heart, and then got a PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology on the East Coast. And I've really, for the next, 25 years or so, sort of worked on the interface between science and policy. I'm a firm believer that if we're going to make good, sound public policy, it has to be deeply embedded by a clear-eyed view of what's actually happening in the world, which is often informed by data and science. And otherwise, we're going to be flying blind into the future with both of our hands tied behind our back. And so I think that's why many of the moves made by the Trump administration are counter to good public policy and put the ocean, I think, ultimately at great risk.
So George, during the first Trump administration, there was sort of a successful public mobilization. His focus seemed to be view the ocean as a gas station, a garbage dump, but mainly opening it up for offshore drilling. There was lots of public opposition. You had Sharpie Gate, which seemed sort of ridiculous at the time, but now there's a real sense of vengeance in his gutting of NOAA. And there's a much more systemic plan afoot to undermine what we think of as a sound ocean policy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. If we look more broadly at what's happening, I think, from the Trump administration, on the one hand, it feels disjointed, unorganized, without a broader strategy. And yet, if you then actually try to focus in on what's happening, it seems to be quite deliberative. And particularly, you know, I spent a lot of time in academia, and the attacks on science and knowledge seem to be comprehensive and unrelenting. And that's really troubling, right? I think it's troubling for a whole generation of upcoming scientists. Undergraduates, graduate students, you know, postdocs, people who are just getting started are having literally the legs cut out from underneath them. And then you combine that, I think, with a real disdain for anything related to renewable energy. Obviously, the ocean has a huge role to play in renewable energy, but there's lots of other places you can get renewable energy, like your rooftop or land-based, you know, wind farms. And you know, they seem to be taking a hatchet to sort of all of those approaches.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at the bill and have looked at it, and it's astounding that he is proposing a $2.2 billion reduction in NOAA's overall funding, and that's going to affect, marine mammals, turtles, coastal habitats, weather, and as you just said, you know, both David and you, George, that it does seem like a real vendetta against NOAA and their protection and science-oriented policies.
Yeah, I think that's right. By one account that I've seen, that there's sort of 18 different sort of line items, if you will, 18 different sort of program areas that NOAA focuses on. And 11 of the 18 aren't just cut, they're just terminated, like $0, 100% reduction, right? And the remaining, you know, experience a cut from somewhere between, you know, 20 and 60%. And none of those cuts, I mean, there's a lot of discussion, right? There's a lot of narrative around efficiency and fraud and waste, but I have yet to see anything that supports those level of cuts really in any of the principles within the reconciliation bill, but certainly in the NOAA space, that has any kind of sort of data-driven justification for cutting fraud and abuse, right? So it really can't be, if it's not that, then it's about hobbling and undermining those efforts.
So we saw when he didn't like the governor of Maine talking back to him, so he cut the Sea Grant to Maine, and then all the lobstermen were up in arms. Now they're doing major cuts to the Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Act, which has gotten America back to sustainable commercial fishing. Fishermen can't be happy with that. Coastal Zone Management Act abolished. That's every coastal state works with the feds to do good coastal management. What are some of the other really egregious things you're seeing in this big, beautiful or big BS bill?
Well, I was going to ask, what do people call it? I keep calling it the reconciliation bill because I refuse to call it the big, beautiful bill. Some I've heard call it the big, ugly bill. But I mean, look, so the first thing that I think is really troubling is the OAR, the Oceanic Research Initiative, right, that holds a whole bunch of basic research and staff scientists that work on a whole range of ocean-related science. Climate, obviously, is a big part of that, but also basic understanding of the role of habitats and the importance of biodiversity and fisheries. That's entirely slated to be cut. I don't know how you pursue any kind of science-based work if you're going to reduce that to zero. So that's a big one.
And that's like 10 laboratories, actually, in climate and weather.
That's right. So then there's, you know, 10 individual facilities that are thought to be closed. But the other big science related piece for NOAA is, many folks probably don't know that we have a big ocean observing system, right, where there are literally high tech buoys and devices deployed around the country, both in coastal waters and in offshore waters, that sort of take the temperature, take the pulse, if you will. And that program as well, at least by my latest look here, is also slated for entire termination.
And so, people say, well, what do I care about, you know, the state of or the temperature of the ocean? One of those ocean observing impacts is it warns people when there are harmful algal blooms, when red tides are coming into Florida, or when the beach is going to be shut down. That warning system is gone. The public's like, go swim at your own risk now.
Or eat shellfish from coastal.
Well, exactly. I mean, harmful algal blooms can make the water, you know, unfit to swim in, but they also have big impacts on shellfish that we eat. And I shellfish poisoning is nothing to laugh at, and it can be extremely dangerous. And so if we don't have good infrastructure and ongoing monitoring, I think people's health is going to be put at risk as well.
I once had a fisheries enforcement agent demonstrate the effects of paralytic shellfish poisoning. He grabbed his throat and he swole his tongue up in his mouth and started gargling and then like flopped around on his desk very realistically. That guy's probably been laid off under this plan.
Probably. You know, but there are other, you know, sort of specific aspects of NOAA that are likewise being hobbled here, right? So one is their ocean acidification program. So, you know, basically burning fossil fuels is doing two things to the ocean. It's making the ocean hotter and it's making the ocean more acidic. About 90% of the heat generated by climate change from burning fossil fuels ends up in the ocean and driving ocean temperatures. The ocean having warmed about 1.37 degrees Fahrenheit in the last century. And it's also making the ocean more acidic. And that's simply because CO2 dissolves in water. And that work has been, you know, the NOAA has spearheaded that work and done a lot of work with coastal shellfish farmers and others to address that issue. And likewise, that work is being cut as well.
And when you think about acidification, what's so important is that you need those calcium carbonate ions. And with acidification, they're being reduced. And so when you think about oysters and mussels and crabs and clams, needing that material as basic building blocks, we're looking at enormous hits to the ocean productivity.
And to livelihoods, too. I mean, usually we talk about indicator species of, sharks or whales. The shellfish industry has become the indicator species for ocean acidification. It's harder for them to grow spat, to grow baby oysters in water that's turning acidic.
Yes, and some of the biggest champions to address, the broader issue of climate change and how it relates to ocean acidification have been shellfish farmers, particularly shellfish farmers out here on the West Coast and in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, it's a big issue. I know that some of them are actually taking their spat to Hawaii to get them started, and then they're having to add lots of components to the water to neutralize it because it's just so acidic when it comes in from the ocean. And that's costing everybody a lot of extra money.
And the scale's phenomenal. We just, at the last Peter Benchley Ocean Awards, we had Senator Whitehouse of Rhode Island say that the heat we're adding to the ocean is the heat equivalent of 6 or 7 Hiroshima bombs every second. I actually had to look that up. I couldn't quite believe that, but the facts.
Yeah, that's hard to believe. I remember when I first heard that sort of social math, I think the math was more like 1 to 2. So I think that's a testament to just, climate change is accelerating. Climate change in the ocean and its heat content is also accelerating. So I think those numbers, much like plastic pollution, which itself is accelerating, those numbers keep getting larger year over year. And the bill is going to make them get larger even more quickly.
And the funny thing is, even if you just want to do what Trump seems to want to do, use it as a gas station, a garbage dump, Trump's pushing deep sea mining now, and yet they've terminated NOAA's Ocean Exploration and Research Division, which is all about exploring the deep ocean and understanding the places where they want to go and exploit.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of things like that don't make sense. So I think if memory serves me, there was an executive order a while back about aquaculture and promoting U.S. aquaculture. And yet there's a cut to the aquaculture program in the reconciliation bill. So what is it? Do we want to support aquaculture or do we want to undermine it? There doesn't seem to be a lot of consistency there.
It just seems so challenging to follow the logic with this budget cut.
It's almost vindictive without logic. It's, taking a chainsaw to places that may need scalpels or may in fact need to be expanded, the science, the understanding. And it's obviously the bill is just sort of this culmination. Most people are hearing about the bill in terms of it'll add $3 or $4 trillion to the budget deficit. It will take Medicaid away from 12 million people. It will give great tax benefits to the rich, but it will also impact our oceans in these many different ways that we're talking about now. And, it's kind of like the ocean, I thought, was the last bipartisan issue. Everybody likes to go to the shore and be able to get in the water. We've become a nation that's sort of a model of doing science-based fishing policy, and that's all going away.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the bipartisan nature of the oceans. And there's been great examples of bipartisan work in the U.S. on oceans and fisheries and other issues. But it's really, when you look at the voting record on this bill, it's pretty astounding. I mean, it's hard to ignore the fact that all the Democrats voted against it and pretty much all the Republicans with a handful of exceptions and not enough of a handful to even sway the overall vote voted against all of it. I would welcome you, both of your perspectives, how we move back to a more, bipartisan, collaborative approach to thinking about what we want the future of this country to be, and in this particular case, what we want the future of ocean science and conservation to be. Because right now, it feels like we're headed in the wrong direction and one that's challenging to perhaps recover from without some brave individuals and some real dedicated effort.
Do you love the salty characters and ocean champions we have on The Rising Tide? So do we, and we're dedicated to bringing inspiring stories and voices that make waves. But here's the catch. We need your support to keep the tide rolling. A tax-deductible donation at bluefront.org will help keep The Rising Tide on the air and online. If you're ready and able to amplify these salty voices for the sea, dive in with a donation, big or small. Visit bluefront.org and join the movement. And now, back to the show.
I also think that it's time for people to start matching up their decisions with their personal consequences of their life. So as we were talking about fishermen, you know, if you see overfishing in certain areas where it's been very well regulated and they're getting their normal catches, or they're able to sell their shellfish without the worry of people being sick, when people start linking up national federal decisions and this bill with their own livelihood, I think that's when people will start realizing, maybe there's an opportunity in the next election cycle to change what's happening. And so I think education really is the key. You know, our podcast, the work that you're doing in your consultations, the work that nonprofits are doing, just getting the word out about what these repercussions are is so important.
100% agree with that, Vicky. And of course, the great irony here, right, is that NOAA had an Office of Education and Outreach, which also is fully terminated at $35.5 million, right? So whatever education and outreach and conversation is going to happen, it doesn't look like it's going to be led by NOAA, at least in the short term.
No, and we're seeing it in other frontline agencies. I mean, EPA, they're because they're pushing to shift the market away from clean energy transition and back to fossil fuels. So they're opening up, promoting really coal-fired power plants, which is a major source of mercury in our tuna. Mercury out of the smokestack that precipitates onto the ocean and into the food web. It's crazy that it's like if the whale oil industry dominated the politics of the 1850s and campaigned to prevent rock oil, petroleum from being developed and ban the research on electricity. I mean, we're literally at a point where the market forces are all for a transition to cleaner, cheaper energy, including offshore wind. And they're trying to like use the political power to shift that balance back to offshore oil and the burning of coal. And environmental democracies don't guarantee environmental improvement, but they never happen under dictatorships. I mean, you need to have democracy in order to have good environmental policy. And so there's this larger issue of, you know, are we moving away from democracy? And is that why we're seeing these irrational power and vengeance driven attacks on our public seas?
Well, that's the $69,000 question, David. I don't have a great answer for that. I was, you know, I'm really just a lowly marine scientist by training. But I do think those are important questions for us to ask. And it certainly seems like the evidence, at least now, is pointing in that direction. You know, you were talking about renewable energy and versus fossil fuels. Maybe we should acknowledge one very small win in the legislative process here. There was an amendment, or part of the bill was going to put additional taxes, so the antithesis of an incentive, on offshore wind and other renewable technologies. That was stripped out of the final version of the bill. And what remains is the tax incentives that are the remainder from the Inflation Reduction Act from the Biden administration will not expire until 2027, so a couple of years from now, giving a slight window for facilities and operations that are under development to sort of get up and running before that rug gets pulled out from underneath them. It's a minor win, but one I think that was hard fought, and all of those sort of minor improvements that made the big bad bill less bad than it might have been is because of advocates amongst the public, leaders in Congress, and folks like yourselves who are bringing these issues to everybody's attention.
And again, another victory was, and people still tend to be more land than water oriented, but another victory was an attempt to sell off public lands, which was defeated. Nobody wants public lands sold off, but we don't think about our marine sanctuaries and monuments in the same way. We need to think that you can't, you know, open up public waters that are protected, as they are planning to do, to fishing and mining and other extractive industries.
Absolutely.
I wanted to just go back to our National Marine Sanctuaries program, something that's vital, absolutely vital for protecting critical habitats and, of course, individual species. And yet they're cutting this program by 60%. And that also includes our national monuments. And I just wanted to know that you are living adjacent to the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. So how do you feel like these impacts are going to affect recovery efforts?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's super disheartening. It's the underwater equivalent of our national park system, right? America's greatest idea, but underwater. You know, I grew up in Massachusetts and I learned to scuba dive when I was very young at 13. And I remember diving off a place called Marblehead Rock and seeing little sea urchins and teeny little plants and a couple of small fish. And I just thought this was the coolest thing ever. Well, then I came to California and I flopped into a kelp forest out here and it just blew my mind away, right? I never thought, wait, you can have 100-foot long kelp plants? I remember sitting on the bottom and watching the California sunflower star, Pycnopodia helianthoides, about as big as a garbage can. And I sat there and watched this starfish run across the bottom, like just pick up and just take off all 24 of its arms, just flying across the bottom. And I was spellbound, right? And I realized pretty quickly that kelp forest off of Monterey was just an example of what was in the Monterey Bay writ large, and then ultimately the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, which was a testament to just the incredible biodiversity and the amazing habitats that we have out here. So yeah, it's really tough to think about what might be the future of that with a sanctuary office that's, you know, going to lose. Well, we don't know how many staff it's going to lose, but we're probably going to lose its superintendent, who's going to take one of these forks in the road. And these are people that, like, I went to graduate school with, right, who have made their life career protecting the coastal ocean here. You know, some of the specifics I've heard is that apparently what the sanctuary program is now saying, you know, through the bill, is that they're only going to maintain the buoys in the sanctuaries. They're going to cease any kind of on-water operations, which I'm still not sure what that means. I assume that means any kind of research or any kind of, you know, basic understanding of the sanctuaries, and that they've also made a statement that they're no longer going to consider any new sanctuaries. Now, the National Marine Sanctuaries Act, right, has a whole process by which new sanctuaries can be nominated and debated, and then management plans are built in a very transparent and open way. But they're going to shut the door on any future sanctuaries. And I think that does a real disservice to the legislation and to the public's ability to identify places that they want to see protected. So yeah, I think it's going to be tough. My worry is that some of the impacts may not happen immediately. And so there's going to be this lag where people are going to get complacent, and then the damage will be done and it will be difficult to rebuild both the capacity and maybe some of the process to pull ourselves back from that. So I think that's why we got to keep focused on trying to reduce and minimize these impacts as much as possible in the immediate short term as well.
So George, in terms of looking at what the administration's doing at this new bill, what are the two or three ocean impacts that you think the marine conservation community should be educating the public around?
If we kind of step way back for a second, right? Like why is this a problem for the ocean? It's important to recognize what are sort of the three big threats right now to ocean health. And the way I often think about this is, you know, in very simplistic terms, what's happening is that we're putting too much stuff into the ocean and we're taking too much stuff out of the ocean. So we're putting in too much carbon, we're putting in too much plastics, we're putting in too much other pollutants, and we're basically taking out too many fish because there is still a global overfishing crisis. And so, you know, the United Nations has framed this up as sort of the triple planetary crisis, where we have climate change, pollution, and biodiversity loss as three separate but connected problems in the ocean. And they all need to be they need to be individually addressed, but they may also need to be addressed in an integrative way, because the ocean is essentially one big connected system. And so if climate change and pollution and biodiversity loss are the big things that we as a society need to be worried about, both here in the US, but obviously around the world, the question is, does this bill make any of those better or worse? And I think it's not hard to make the argument that for all three of those problems, this bill is going to make them worse. It's going to accelerate climate change, not solve it. It's going to make the ocean, therefore, hotter, more acidic, continue to lose oxygen. And that trend may continue. So as well as you said, David, increased mercury from fossil fuels and increased oil spills, because there's always oil spills when you drill in the ocean. So pollution is going to be worse. And then biodiversity loss is either going to be affected by things like pulling the rug out from underneath salmon, which are essentially on the verge of extinction and have been for a while, as well as putting blinders on our ability to understand how many fish are in the ocean so we can figure out how many we can kind of safely catch while allowing there to be enough to remain to repopulate. So there's a lot of details in this bill. It's 1,000 pages long. I will say I have not read all 1,000 pages. It's hard just to keep up with the ocean pieces. But I think at the broadest level, what's happening here is going to accelerate the big three problems in the ocean. And as a result, contribute not to solving, but to making worse the triple planetary crisis that the United Nations has told us we are deeply embedded in right now.
Ooh. So the bad good summary. good summary of bad news.
Yes.
And I just say, you know, if you love the ocean, you have to love democracy too, and you have to fight like hell to turn the tide here.
Well, absolutely. This is not a time to give up, right? There were a lot of warriors in this bill. I just saw a headline this morning that some of the Republicans have already started to push back a bit on some of the NOAA impacts, largely because of advocacy from folks like yourselves and other members of the public and other elected officials. So, you know, I think we are, while the bill is passed and signed on July 4th, we are still, I think, in early days of what this actually is going to mean on the water. And we need to keep focused on that.
So as a sign of optimism, in which we like to wrap up, more opportunities for the public to get our voices out, to make sure that we go out and vote in the midterms and keep the ocean as a priority. And with that, George Leonard, former chief scientist at Ocean Conservancy and an ocean science policy consultant, thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast.
Thank you, Vicki. Thank you, David.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helvark and me, Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear, it's true. It's the Blue Frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.